all of us appreciate your presence. I'm going to talk about some work that I did with Claire Barnett and the Healthy Schools Network, trying to look at children's health in schools and how the environment in the schools impact on the kids' health. And I have no conflicts of interest to declare or relationships to disclose. If you want more details about what we're talking about this morning, you can go to this publication that was in New Solutions in 2010, Who's in Charge of Children's Environmental Health at Schools, by Claire and myself. So we're really very much at a loss for how to talk intelligently about what goes on in schools as it relates to the school environment and children's health, because there's really no data set that one can go to look at the status of schools. They're on a national scale. There may be individual state information or county information or school district information, but there's no national data set. In the 1990s, the GAO reported that the average school building at that time was 42 years old. Now there's been new building, old schools have closed, but then some old buildings have just gotten older and they haven't been shut down. And one of the things they clearly found was a lot of deferred maintenance. And that put about 13 million children at that time who were in these old buildings and at risk of exposure to environmental hazards. And the hazards that were identified in the schools were very extensive, ranging from indoor air quality to noise to radon to asbestos, cleaning products, and where the schools themselves were located. So this is not a one-shot deal. This is not something where one particular tweak will solve all of the problems. And there are some problems which have been addressed at a national level in a partial kind of way, and then there are other problems which really have not been addressed. So we have the issue of outdoor air pollution, particularly fumes coming from idling buses, and there has been a voluntary EPA school bus program to talk about retrofitting those buses with better engines and not having those buses idle outside of schools, and a number of schools have adopted no idling policies. We have, we want to make the schools a better place, but one of the problems is when school districts decide to do renovation when the students and teachers are present and they're not separating the kids and the teachers and the other staff from those hazardous substances that are involved in the building or created by the demolition. Schools need land, and in many areas, the only land that's available is old industrial land, former commercial spaces, former brownfields or unremediated brownfields. Some schools get built very close to Superfund sites. The EPA did several years ago issue a very comprehensive set of school siting guidelines, but again, these are voluntary and schools can choose to use them or not. There have been efforts on the part of EPA to encourage schools to clean out old chemicals from laboratories, and where this has been done, they have found old toxic and explosive chemicals stored willy-nilly in closets. Nobody really knows that they're there, how to use them, how to handle them safely, or how to get rid of them. And there are still schools which have not participated in this voluntary program, so these chemicals are still in place in schools. Chemicals get spilled in schools. Sometimes these old unidentified chemicals are spilled. There have been numerous reports of mercury spills in schools. We had a situation in the District of Columbia That cost quite a bit of money to clean up. It also involved an apartment building outside of school where the mercury got tracked to, and a bunch of buses. So there is the EPA voluntary school chemical cleanout program, but that is no longer funded. Of course, we're used to the notion that kids get sick in school. You know, you send your healthy kid to school on Monday, and by Friday, they come home with the sniffles. And to some extent, that's par for the course. But the reality is, if there were a mechanism for identifying and tracking those problems, we might be able to identify clusters of problems that may be related to issues in the school themselves. Several years ago, there was a series of reports in USA Today about air toxics from industrial sites, highways, and things like that that were impacting on the outdoor and indoor air quality in schools. There have been a number of cases where PCB-laden caulk that was common in the 1960s is still in place in schools, and as it deteriorates, creates potential problems for the inhabitants of those buildings. And in spite of the fact of a long-standing program to encourage school water quality and search for sources of lead, there are still problems with schools that are newly identified or re-identified as having lead in water. There is the Asbestos Hazard Emergency Response Act that talks about how schools are supposed to manage asbestos, but this is, again, not a mandatory program, and many school facilities programs do not adhere to ADHERA. So the other issue that we need to consider is radon in schools. Schools have basements, or schools are built on slabs, and just like homes, they can have radon. Unless somebody bothers to check, there can be high radon levels in the classrooms, and nobody does anything about it. For as far as indoor air quality is concerned, there is no governmental agency, federal, state, or local that regulates indoor air except for laws pertaining to smoking. So again, we have a lot of laws and regulations in this country that talk about outdoor air pollution, but there is nothing that talks about indoor air quality other than laws and the related regs that pertain to smoking. So within Tools for Schools and Healthy School Environment Assessment Tools, both of which were compiled and published by the EPA, there are a lot of recommendations that, if followed, would lead to improved indoor air quality in schools. Tools for Schools is no longer funded or updated, but the materials are on the web. And both of these programs rely on voluntary compliance. Some school districts have said this will be the policy for our particular school district, but again, on a national basis, there's no requirement for implementation of these programs. Schools are, by their very nature, places where pests can be. Kids eat lunch, their cafeterias, their teacher break rooms. There are plenty of places to attract pests. And unfortunately, there are still many schools, we don't know how many because, again, there's no data set, that do use routine pesticide spraying as the means of controlling pests in schools. And that's inappropriate. There should be no routine spraying of pesticides in or around school buildings. Schools should be required to use an integrated pest management approach. There are some states where this has been mandated, but again, on a national level, there are no standards. So neither the U.S. Department of Education, none of the agencies within the Department of Health and Human Services, such as the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics or the National Center for Environmental Health, nor the EPA, collect data on a systematic basis related to environment, related to health issues and the environment within schools. So it makes the recognition of new problems very difficult. We do have a very, very small public health tracking effort in this country where they have tried to use schools as the nexus for the tracking of data. It has been extremely difficult, and most of those attempts have failed. And they have floundered primarily over this issue of Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, which is known as FERPA. If the data belongs to the schools, that is, for example, if the school nurses work for the school district, then you require an individual permission from the child's parent to, and later as the kids get older, from the kids, to release any of the data that may be collected by the school nurse. We need a way of figuring out how to build schools so that they support the health and learning of the children who are in them, and so that they support the health of the adults who are there as well. Most of the decisions about school construction and the policies around school construction are made at the state levels. The Federal Department of Education does not regulate any of this activity. There used to be an Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools that no longer exists either, but it really did not get involved in environmental health or safety issues. Part of the issue and why there is not a national data collection is, think back, schools in many instances antedated even the states in this country. And so there's school districts here in Massachusetts that go back to colonial times. As we as a nation expanded westward, there were school districts that were set up before those territories became states. And so schools are among the most locally controlled of public institutions in the United States of America. There are now in states state education agencies, but they really focus on educational policy, a little bit on buildings, and have no focus on environmental issues at all. These responsibilities often fall to local school districts, and school districts can be totally independent from either the city or the county government that they're in, because they have their own taxing authority, they raise their own funds, and they make their own decisions. Some of you are aware, just from reading in the newspaper, about the arguments that have gone on in a number of places in the United States over the last 5 to 10 years about, you know, will the mayor or the county take over the schools and run the schools as part of the city or county government as opposed to an independent school board? And that's obviously been a very hot issue in many localities. Adults get better protection in school buildings than kids do. So there is the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970, and it covers workers in a number of places, but may not cover state employees, where there are 25 states that have their own occupational safety and health programs, but they tend to mirror the federal OSHA program. The teachers in most schools are unionized, so if they have problems, they can complain to their union about the mold in classroom 437, whereas the kids don't have a union to go to complain about that mold in room 437. States have departments of labor that may have oversight over other adults in the building, but again, not the kids. Workers who are injured on the job have access to workers' compensation programs, but not the kids. Workers can call in sick, and kids can do that too, to a limited extent, but if the kids call in sick too much, they're going to fail. The teachers can request a change in schools, and the kids can sort of do that too, but at a pragmatic level, you know, are you going to really be able to get your kid to school that's not your neighborhood school? So kids' mobility to look for a healthier, safer building may be more limited than the adults. If kids and parents turn to their pediatricians, most of us really are not trained to identify or deal with environmental health problems. And you really need a multi-pronged approach. You need somebody with training in pediatrics to help the kid. You need somebody with training in buildings to help the building, an industrial hygienist. And you need a facilities management expert who can deal with the HVAC system, the floor cleaning system, et cetera, et cetera. Pediatric environmental health specialty units, there are 10 of them in the country. I run one that serves Region 3. And we are a resource for schools and pediatricians and parents, and we can provide education on these topics, and we can do some limited consultation. But right now, we don't have the capabilities, except on a very limited basis with the Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit in Kansas City, to actually go into buildings and do inspections. The PESUs are funded indirectly by ATSDR and EPA. There is one in each region of the country, and so if you're looking to consult with your regional PESU, go to www.pehsu.net. We deal with all sorts of programs. Indoor air quality is certainly one. Lead, asbestos, a number of things that impact on schools, we can at least provide some advice for, and all of us have a toll-free number, a website, and information about all of the units, again, are at that www.pehsu.net. So in conclusion, nobody's in charge. You know, kids are really on their own. Adults have some protection from environmental health hazards, kids have none. And there's no system for gathering data to document or track. There's no baseline data against which to make comparisons. The EPA voluntary guidelines are good, but they have no way of ensuring that people use them. So we need a federal agency that can have a program in school environmental health that can track and monitor, gather data, fund and conduct research, and develop and enforce nationally recognized regulations. And the PESUs can be part of that system. I'll take one or two questions now, and then as a panel at the end, we'll take some other questions.